In the previous videos, the object on the bed were cats. In this video, it was an actual person. And I'm like, what the fuck? At this point, I am fully awake. My heart is pounding. I immediately jump out of bed, run to my computer, and turn it on. Come on, computer, let's go, let's go, let's go. Now I'm watching it on my large monitor, and I've got it full screen. Holy shit.
What a good boy he was. How can I live without him? I just cannot listen to him singing. Any recording of his voice only makes me miss him more. I wish he could be standing right in front of me now. I'm missing him so much. Every day I feel like the walking dead. The walking dead.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. With me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and we are back with Cats. Not the musical Cats.
Oh my goodness, Lisa. We definitely don't want to be talking about the musical Cats.
No, we don't.
No, we don't
want to fuck kind of with cats either, right?
Yeah, so over the holidays, I guess this documentary has just really exploded on everybody's been watching it or trying to watch it. And a lot of our listeners have been very conflicted about if they can actually watch it, if they can get through it, if they need to cover their eyes through parts of it. It's very disturbing to a lot of people, although people want to watch it. Some people just can't. They can't get through the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is just that old adage of what we spoke about before. And when we think about it, there are more animal shelters than there are human shelters. When we think about domestic violence, people love their animals. And I still find it really interesting that Deanna hadn't watched the videos from beginning to end, and that she went through that, because I still think very much you can't unsee what you've seen.
Right.
And for her having to sit there and watch the whole thing from beginning, middle, and end, because actually I was listening to an interview by Mark Lewis, the director. He said that there were some clues, more evidence within those bits of footage, and that's really why she put herself through it. So I do get it. I think, as we talked about last time, we all watched it through our hands and hoping that they weren't going to show all the details.
And right. They didn't. And I think they really deserve a lot of credit for Mark Lewis just walking us right up to the line so that we can sort of see how excruciating what the offender did was, but not crossing that line. Would you agree that there was nothing gratuitous about what they showed?
Yeah, I think it was very well done. And Laura, I remember when I had to look at the crush videos at the BAU, and I literally couldn't get through more than 45 seconds of them. They were so horrific. I don't know why it assaulted my senses so much more than the videos that I saw and the pictures I saw of humans at crime scenes. But I guess maybe it was I've never seen, well, aside from war footage, where there's actually videos of humans killing other humans, I haven't seen graphic footage of people committing murder until the videos that were uploaded by this offender.
Yeah, I think it's very true. We don't see those crimes in action, and therefore just seeing it just so blatantly. I mean, we're going to get into Jun Lin, because I think where we left off in our last episode discussion, it was really we'd covered episode one, and episode two is obviously when we realize that there is a human being involved.
Right.
And that is shocking for everybody. But I think the victimology, I don't know if they covered it quite so well. I would have liked to have heard a little bit more, but I do think that Benjamin, his best friend, Benjamin Zhu, did do a fantastic job of talking about who he was. So perhaps let's start with that, shall we? Jun Lin was 33, and that he'd left China. I actually listened to an interview with both of his parents. I don't know if you saw any of that footage.
I didn't see it, but I did read his father's victim statement, which I found very moving and unbelievably gracious.
His father, Diran Lin, and wife, Juvadu, and I hope I'm saying that correctly, I heard them both speak on different interviews, but it just was heartbreaking, Jim and Lisa. Yeah. I mean, just hearing them talk about their only son, because for them in China, having a boy, the eldest boy, obviously means a huge amount, but just having one child and losing him in such a brutal way. And I think the thing that really resonated just on the impact was just hearing mum say, Jugvadu, that she had to keep watching her son being murdered over and over and over and over again.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
It really made me think about it in a different way, because we don't normally, as you said, Jim, we don't normally see the footage, but this is still viral. You know, this is something that's still out there. So for the family, as we always do, I just want to pay respects to them, because although this was an internet sensation of everyone watching this documentary, there's a very real person. And for them, probably even having everyone talking about it, it just opens everything up again for them. And they said such lovely things about their son, you know, that how he was quiet, but he was very shy, but very smart, very intelligent. Mm. And that he was an undergraduate at Concordia University in Montreal studying engineering and computer science, and how proud they were of him. You know, he'd gone to Canada. I think this is one of the hardest things. He'd followed his dream to live in Canada and make a new life. And that he had just spoken with his mother, just showing her some of the footage of in a park, showing what he could see to his mom, and saying, see how beautiful it is here and how safe it is here.
Wow, that's horrible. But what's another thing that I thought was very poignant was when Benjamin, his friend, said that the ripple effects are still being felt today, and how this senseless, horrific murder actually affected Junlin's entire family. And his responsibility as the eldest son was to take care of his parents when they got old. And now they don't have that anymore. And, you know, it's a really horrible look at what people do when they kill a human being, when they take somebody out of their family and their circle of friends and their education or employment, that there's people that feel it going on into infinity.
Yeah, I mean, it really is that ripples on a pond. I think that's a really good way to describe it. So many people get touched, and it really does have an impact. And I think when he also talked, Benjamin Zhu, about Junlin having this cat that he adored in his apartment, and because he hadn't been home and hadn't fed the cat, he knew something really horrible had happened. Right. But of course, that tells us a lot about him and his nature, that he was an animal lover that looked after this cat. And when he said he was going to be somewhere, he was there. And of course, he just disappeared and he didn't know where he was. So I think the irony as well of having a cat, and this individual obviously murdered cats before he lured him. And I would say he was a vulnerable person, because he answered an advert, you know, from Craigslist. And he took a bit of a leap of faith in answering that advert. And probably when he first met the perpetrator, he probably didn't feel a sense of fear or danger. But what then unfolded was something very different that he would never have imagined.
Yeah, I wonder what that, as a newcomer to Canada, he probably didn't have a lot of friends. He probably certainly hadn't gotten into a circle of people who were out. He probably wasn't out to his parents, I would think. And this would be one of the few ways that he could meet somebody and
start a relationship.
Start a relationship. Yeah.
And
do you think
top
he was
that,
a high-risk victim or a low-risk victim, would you say?
Oh. Well, he's a low-risk victim, but he's engaged in activity that turned out to be very high-risk. We call that a mixed-risk victim. And what that means is somebody who generally you wouldn't expect to be in a bad situation, but because of a particular activity, they're actually exposed to a lot more risk. And in this case, I'm sure that Junlin, feeling he's in Canada, he's in one of the safest countries on the planet.
Friendliest country in the world.
Yeah, everybody there is just friendly and open. And of course, that made him more trusting and, in fact, more vulnerable. It's just very sad. And one of the saddest things is when you see the little clips of video of him walking into the front vestibule of the building and knowing that he's walking to his torture and death. It's just terrible.
And for those of you who haven't seen the Netflix show, there is a security camera footage in the offender's apartment building where you see the offender and Jun Lin just walking in, just nothing.
Very casual.
Just two guys, very casually. They're just two guys walking in. But yeah, we know what's going to happen to him, and it's horrifying.
Because now I knew what the suspect looked like, we started to look at more security footage of the Carrie building that was looking at in a few days before the torso had been found. And at one point, I was able to see two people, two young men in their late 20s, entering the building. One was the suspect that we had seen in the post office. And the other one didn't seem to be like a white person. Seemed maybe to be like a little darker, maybe Asian, maybe South American. I started to look through the missing persons reports, and I fall upon a name, Jun Lin.
I guess this is where in episode 2, it's called Killing for Clicks. This is where we move from the digital arena of what's going on, but safe behind a keyboard, to now something much more sinister, and it becomes much more real world stuff. The safety aspect has gone. And we also learn about Deanna and the fact that she was so freaked out by seeing the footage of her casino. And that's actually, I just double checked it, that Deanna was so upset by watching the video One Lunatic, One Ice Pick. But when what you see up on screen is also her full name on Facebook. And so I wonder, she must have had multiple profiles. And of course, he spent time on Facebook watching them to see what they were up to as well. So this is where she gets very upset, because it's not just Jun Lin that's on the video. It's also a little puppy that's also introduced. And right. I think it's interesting, again, people's reactions, you know, to that. And you know that if Jun Lin is going to be killed, then that puppy most likely would be too. For what purpose? Why introduce a puppy into it? What are your thoughts on that, Jim and Lisa?
I think to add to the horror, to add to the very senseless killing of a completely helpless being that is known as man's best friend, right? Why not add that to the mix when you're trying to do something demented and horrific and something outrageous for clicks? It is just a complete lack of human emotion. And I think it is something that's very psychopathic.
Yeah, it seems so over the top. I mean, you're already killing and mutilating, trigger alert, everyone, a human being in the worst, in the most horrific way. But I think there was also not only a puppy in the video, I think there was also a rabbit in the video, trigger alert, that the offender feeds some of the human body parts to this bunny. So I don't know. I don't know. Is there a level of psychopathy that this person, is there another label for this kind of offender? I mean,
what I also learned, and it relates to this, Lisa, is that he had written two blogs, and this was just before Jun Lin was murdered. There was one blog that he called Necrophiliac Sexual Killer, and then he had his name. That was a blog that he wrote in, I think it was the March of 2012. And then he wrote another blog. It wasn't a blog, actually. I think it was something to do with a video. But there was another blog about cannibalism. And there was another video, I think, about cannibalism and necrophilia. And, of course, what actually happened on the video, I mean, we didn't see it all, right? But I did do a little bit of research. Mm. And remember I talked about the students who were filming themselves reacting to it. He apparently does sodomize Jun Lin when he's incapacitated, and you know, he masturbates with the body, and there is a suggestion about the fact that he sodomized him. And so we have necrophilia potentially there. And so these blogs that are written beforehand, you know, is this about doing the most shocking thing possible? And I guess it talks to what you said, Jim, because I do think this is about doing the most heinous, shocking things. All of the, you know, the fact with the animals, the kittens, was about getting the attention. And then we've got necrophilia and cannibalism introduced.
And those are paraphilias, for our listeners who may not know. Necrophilia is a sexual attraction to sexual activity with a dead body. And these are very extreme paraphilias, I would say. There are some paraphilias where somebody has a fetish for, let's say, spiked high heels, and that can sort of integrate into their life and sort of take over their sexual fantasies, and it can become a paraphilia. But there are other paraphilias that are actually extreme and illegal. Pedophilia is one of them. That's a very common one, unfortunately. And then this, necrophilia, which would be the sexual attraction to and having sex with a corpse. Lisa, you said, is there a higher level of of psychopathy? Well, when you have psychopathy mixed with one of those extreme or a group of extreme paraphilias, because, right, Laura, we see, when we see paraphilias, especially extreme ones, we typically see groupings of paraphilias, so multiple paraphilias at once. And this particular offender is exhibiting that kind of behavior where he most likely has multiple paraphilias. And these are things that are satisfying inner needs of his, and they're totally selfish, 100% selfish. It's all about him. And isn't that totally consistent with what you see of this particular offender, Laura?
It is. I mean, it's the consistent part, the things that he's doing for attention, but then just taking it to the next level. And I mean, we didn't see him in those acts, but seeing him after the act suggests to me that he did enjoy what he was doing. Mm-hmm. When we see him actually wearing Jun Lin's yellow T-shirt, for example, which really, it's just another level of kind of like the fuck you, the enjoyment aspect. That's how I took it, him downstairs just wearing the T-shirt and then putting the body parts in the bag and looking at his own image in the mirror and doing his hair and that whole cosmetic management again. It just really talks to how really divorced he is from reality.
And narcissistic.
Oh, yeah. His narcissism is very, very high levels of narcissism, for sure.
So, and we'll get to this later when we talk about what happens next, but this behavior, this post-defense behavior, is very critical to us in our analysis, because normal human beings who commit extreme acts like this would have almost a downward spiral. They would react in a very intense way to the fact that they committed these acts. On the other hand, a psychopath, an extreme psychopath, a very high-scoring psychopath on the psychopathy checklist, would recover like that. Just matter of fact, next thing, go on. And basically, it doesn't really affect their life. However, there's going to be things that are said and done later that this disproves, this kind of behavior disproves. And we'll talk about that later when we get into the discussion of Manny.
I have a question. I've never asked you this before, either of you, but can you be a murderer and not be a psychopath?
Oh, yeah, yes. Absolutely.
Okay.
Short.
So there's a spectrum of behavior that ends up in murder. And so there are some murders that end up being called manslaughter because there was some impending event that caused it. And so there are emotional responses to catching your partner in bed with somebody else. There's rage that can take over. There's sort of mob mentality that people can do things together that they would never do alone. And we're moving along a spectrum closer and closer to these premeditated, unfeeling, just random taking of human lives. I mean, he's on the scale with sort of the DC sniper, whereas there are other murderers who are convicted of murder, but it was something that basically was an act of passion sort of gone awry, as opposed to something they planned to do and that they really were thrilled by. They got off on it, as this particular offender did.
Although many with this so-called crime of passion, just to throw in there, because I've worked many cases where it was so-called crime of passion, red mist, and actually all the evidence points to the opposite.
That they've there was been thinking about
planning,
it for a long time, right?
Yeah, rumination, internet searches, premeditation. And yet, particularly with domestic violence murderers, actually, there's many that claim it was in the moment, red mist, she forced me to do it. And actually what we see is that there was planning and premeditation.
Right,
that loss of control defense does get overused, I would say.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And I think that that's actually why I didn't say murder of passion, because I don't believe that it's actually passion. I believe it's extreme revenge. When you see, for example, if you're in a situation and you see your partner with somebody else and you act with rage and kill that person, I think what it is that your self-image is so damaged that you're attacking back. And so I don't think that our justice system recognizes the real behavior behind it. But because, and I think this is probably a misogynistic holdover from hundreds of years ago, because our system basically says, hey, if somebody does something that bad to you, yeah, it's almost like they kind of almost made you do it, or they kind of almost deserve it. And that's something that I think is archaic, that shouldn't be part of our justice system anymore, but it still is.
Yeah, for sure. And the gender bias. And, you know, just while you were talking, Jim, I was just running through my head so many different cases that I've been involved with. But even when we had David Challen on talking about Sally Challen's case, where, you know, that could have been argued as this crime of passion, in inverted commas, in the moment. But what we saw beforehand was a load of control behavior. She was the true victim. However, that wasn't ever put forward as a defense. And she ended up getting a 22-year sentence, which, by the way, is unheard of in the British system for domestic violence murder. It is an extreme.
But she's
sentence.
A woman, Laura. She's a woman.
And therefore, she must be punished, you know, more severely. So we see that. We see the gender bias. And too often, I think people allow this red mist defense and they don't check the evidence. They don't test it because they buy into the perpetrator's narrative. Right. And more often than not, it's men that we're talking about, men who kill. And their narrative becomes the dominant one. And just to say, just as a quick segue, because today something very important happened in New York, but also in LA, talking about men taking control. Harvey Weinstein appeared in court at the start of his trial. And I had a wager on that it would be a wheelchair, but it was actually a walker.
Oh, yeah.
So I got the W right. I knew it would be something to try and incite sympathy.
Was he using that same walker when he went to that comedy club recently and made an ass of himself?
I don't think he was, Jim. Or when he was eating ice cream. But the walker was back out. And of course, you know, all the media were in New York. I was following very closely, but LA's district attorney also gave a press statement that he has now been charged with two offenses here in LA.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
Which I'm really pleased to hear. So that narrative taking, I've been calling it poor me syndrome, you know, hashtag poor me syndrome, hashtag PMS, because I always tend to see it across serial abuser cases at the point of accountability. It's amazing how it suddenly impacts a defendant's ability to walk, isn't it, Jim?
Well, isn't that exactly what Bill Cosby did? I mean, now...
It is. I've got a lovely picture of him and his walking frame.
Yes, and he's, you know, holding on to his lawyers because he's blind. He can't even see where he's going. The man is getting old, but the fact is that he has done horrific things to so many women that he deserves whatever he gets.
And, oh, he really does.
And I think, fortunately, Weinstein is going to have to pay, it appears, hasn't happened yet, but it appears that he's going to have to pay for some of the things that he did.
Well, I hope that to be the case, because on the weekend, of course, he decided to email CBS and try and get his version of events out back again. It really is quite astounding. And his lawyer, Donna Rotuno, was doing his bidding and attacking the as she calls it, the accusers, the victims, and saying this is just sexual misconduct. He's not a rapist. And she just keeps saying he's not a rapist. And I keep saying, well, let's the court decide that, shall we?
Yeah.
Why do we need to hear your opinion on it?
And sexual misconduct. Hello? Rape is sexual misconduct. It's a category of sexual misconduct. So to say it's not rape, but it's sexual misconduct, like sexual misconduct is a really good thing.
It's a very bizarre. I do find it really interesting. And but the judge, Judge Burke, hasn't put a gagging order in place, which I would like to see, because I still think it's very problematic having him and his lawyer keep talking out in the media and trying to control the narrative. But that's exactly what we're talking about here, control of narrative and trying to control people's reactions. And you'll probably remember the Golden State Killer. He was in his wheelchair.
I was going to mention him, exactly.
Peter Tobin was in his wheelchair. And then we had Oscar Pistorius. He took his legs off, didn't he? And, you know, was trying to elicit sympathy that way. And there have been so many of them who go to control the narrative. And this individual here, you know, we're not mentioning the killer's name. He tried to control the narrative in every way, online and offline.
Yes, he did.
Oh my God, okay, maybe he went to Montreal. And we just opened up Google Maps and started walking down the streets digitally.
And we're literally going through the street view and going step by step by step down the street. And so I'm going down one street, she's going down another street. I'm going down this street, she's going down another street. I'm going down this street, she's going down another street. Then now all of a sudden, I go, holy shit. There's the stairs, right there.
To add about Deanna and John, I would hire them on my team in a flash. They kind of put themselves down and saying that they're just internet nerds and sleuthers, but they just did such an incredible job. They would be a huge asset to in terms of how they did this.
I, whenever John talks, I feel like I'm watching an episode of Big Bang Theory. I really do. I mean, he's so quintessentially the nerd, right? But he's good. He's very practical, and so is Deanna. And They're very good investigators, very detail-oriented, very ingenuitive in terms of how they're going to find something that, when you say a needle in a haystack, it's a needle in a billion tons of needles. You know, when you literally, when you think about the fact that they saw a picture of this offender on a stone staircase. They see the crossing light, and because it's yellow, they knew it's in this Canadian city. And they literally go on Google Earth, and they scroll down the street. They click their way down street after street after street after street. I mean, a seemingly impossible task, just unsurmountable, like climbing Everest, for example. And they actually find it. That is just amazing.
Yeah, it's genius. It really is.
But even though they find it, like, they can't get anybody's attention. I mean, they've seen this horrifying video. They know that now this offender has graduated from animals to people. They know that any minute now somebody's going to discover this body and he will have gotten away. And so they have such urgency, but they still, you know, they contact a Toronto detective. They do all kinds of things, and they just don't get any attention.
And that,
until the body is found.
Well, until the body is found, and then they realize there's a video of it online. But that's the way law enforcement pretty much works. I mean, they don't necessarily interact with online entities as a rule. They literally, especially when you go back a few years, they don't really give much weight to, you know, citizen sleuths. And that's something that may be changing. And I think now with the number of shows that actually engage listeners like Bob Ruff's Truth and Justice podcast, where Bob's been a guest on our podcast a number of times and we've guested on his, and Bob engages people across the country and around the world to actually conduct investigations, and they've had results. They've exonerated people, gotten them out of prison after serving long terms unjustly. And it's all due to the fact that these people kind of all pitch in, just like Deanna and John, and do an investigation and actually prove that somebody else committed these crimes. So this is something that's an evolving form of law enforcement and investigation. And I'm all for it as long as the people on the citizen side are being safe and they're motivated by the right motivations. Because unfortunately, some people, for example, who get involved in citizen investigations of things like child pornography are actually interested in child pornography, and they use it as an excuse to sort of sublimate that desire. I don't like to see that kind of thing. But on the other hand, there are many people that do care and that do help selflessly. They spend, you know, literally hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of their time to help. And it's very frustrating for them when law enforcement doesn't listen.
Sure. There's two things that I was thinking about when our listeners were, quite a lot were messaging in, when I've been debating with my friends as well. And they say, well, what can we do? How do we get people's attention? Because I think that that's a very, very real problem. And I think one is, as you mentioned, Jim, Bob Ruff, and, you know, it's Pool Holes. We do documentaries and help people. There are a number of very credible people doing work outside of law enforcement that can also be contacted. And liaisons. Not to say...
Yeah,
you can call it in or have a conversation with someone once there's been some, I guess, due diligence to what's being said and what's being done. So there are different ways of doing it. You don't have to go directly to law enforcement. There are lots of people now, particularly with the proliferation of true crime, who are doing great things in the true crime space.
Yeah, somebody like Chris Gofford, who's an investigative reporter, you know, turning him on to something that you think is going on is probably a good avenue too.
Yeah, getting people interested. And do you remember, Lisa, when we had John Sedell on from Chicago,
yeah,
you know, courts, the federal courts reporter, and he said he's interested in hearing from people about what his next project should be, you know, if real cases and looking at them. So there are lots of people out there looking for, you know, bona fide cases and investigations to look at. So there's that avenue as well. But I think when Deanna said that she was angry that no one responded to her, she says, we just don't have the credibility. That is a major problem. And
well, they have it now.
Well, they do now, yes. But, you know, for them, like saying it, that it's going to happen, and then it does happen, and knowing that actually it could have been prevented. And I know I said last time, I think Lisa had mentioned about the killer changing his name, or you said it was a moniker, and I said no, he actually changed his name. I just want to make mention of what I found out about his name, because he did change his name in 2006, and it's because he had in 2004 met a very vulnerable woman online, and he basically sexually assaulted her and recorded it, and he also defrauded her, ran up all her credit cards, etc. And he was brought to book for that. He was actually arrested and charged for it. And he was put before the courts, but the sexual assault charges were dropped at the 11th hour. And he was charged for fraud only. And had he have been charged for the sex offences, and again, Jim, this is a very clear lesson of prevention, that he would have been on the sex offenders register. Now, that's not saying that would have totally stopped his behaviour, but it, again, it's another point where there could have been an intervention and he would have had a forensic profile as a rapist. And of course, he changed his name. Well, I have to say, so many stalkers change their names by DPOL, and many sex offenders do as well. But had that information have got to the homicide investigation team or to somebody who did give some credence to what Deanna and John were saying, well, then maybe they would have done a bit of digging and found, made 2 and 2 equal 4. And maybe there could have been something done, because there, across this case, there are at least 4 points of intervention where someone, if they had taken Deanna and John or the psychiatrist who originally assessed this individual way back when, then, and various police departments, including New Scotland Yard, then actually there are at least 5 points of intervention where the dots may have been joined up. And maybe there could have been a different outcome. As I said, I'm always looking for that, those intervention and those learning points, because it's really important that people understand why it's important to charge a young offender with rape if they are raping vulnerable young women.
Yeah, it's like the rapist turned serial killer in the University of Virginia case, where this guy gets kicked out of a Christian college because he had sex with a girl. Well, actually, she reported that he raped her. And he was on the football team, and they convinced her not to press charges. So they only kicked him out of school because he admitted to having sex while he was at the school. And then he goes out and becomes a taxi driver by another school and picks up at least 3 women, I believe, that we know of, that he then rapes and kills. So another point of potential intervention avoided because somebody wants to wash their hands and not have to deal with that and not have on their record a rape registered at their school.
Right. Yeah, and this is where you get a false forensic profile. It's a major problem, and we see it happening all the time, plea deals being made, and so the real charge not being seen, or the offender describes it as something else. As we're talking to Chris Goffard about the 2 serial killers, and one of them describing the fact that his wife was trying, or ex-partner was trying to stop him from seeing his daughter. Well, he didn't say that he kidnapped them both at knife point and raped the mother. He made a very different, or created a very different narrative. And that's why it's important for us to forensically deconstruct these cases and talk about not just the things that went on, but what are the learning points? How do we get better? Because we know so many professionals listen to the podcast as well. And of course, anyone can make an intervention, be an upstander, as I keep saying, an upstander rather than a bystander when we see things that are suspicious or that don't look right or feel right, or we see someone being abused. We can all stand up and be the voice of someone who perhaps has lost their voice. That's an important part of it, not accepting what's going on. But yes, we've only got through part 2 of Don't Fuck With Cats, and we've still got the Closing the Net part 3 to discuss. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
The Case of Sally Challen, The Teacher's Pet, Lynette Dawson, The Exonerated 5 and When They See Us, and The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233. Thank you.